At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Weekly. Today is Wednesday, May 28th, 2025, and on today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the latest film and TV news, and we'll also present some interviews with the folks behind Rick and Morty and the new Disney Pixar movie, Elio. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com. And to help kick off today's episode, we're going to talk about Rick and Morty Season 8. I am joined now by Slash Film editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
And Slash Film staff writer Michael Boyle.
Hello.
All right, so we're going to talk about this season as a whole in a non-spoilery way and then get into some specifics about the premiere episode, which aired this past Sunday as everyone is listening to this. So, Michael, I want to start with you. Broadly speaking, how do you think season 8 compares to other seasons of this show?
Well, before we do that, to be clear, we've only seen 4 episodes of season 8 and not the first 4 episodes. It was episode 1, 3, 4, and 5.
Oh, wow. That's a weird dynamic. Okay. All right. Well, with that in mind, Michael, answer that question as best you can.
Yeah. So I don't know what's going on in episode 2, which we didn't get. I'm assuming something huge happens. But of the 4 episodes we got, I would say I loved 2 of them and did not care for another 2 of them. It felt hit or miss in a way that seems similar to like season 4 or 5, but the episodes, when it does hit, it hits really well for me. So one good thing about it, it doesn't feel like the show is out of ideas at all, which is a good sign, I think.
Okay, what did you think about the 4 that you're able to watch, Brad?
Yeah, I think if there's one thing that's missing from these 4 episodes, and this is the kind of thing that could easily be present in the other episodes that we haven't seen, is it feels like there's not necessarily a lot of like emotional depth or like substance in some of them. They're still a lot of fun. They do a lot of great pop culture, like mixing between like sci-fi movies and stuff like that. Like there's stuff with The Matrix, there's stuff with Edge of Tomorrow. There's a really crazy Cronenberg-esque approach to the Santa Claus, but with a different holiday twist. So there's like a lot of really cool stuff that happens. But aside from the Citadel episode, which we did get to see one of those in the episodes presented, it feels like that there's not any hugely significant developments or emotional beats that we typically get for either, you know, Rick or Morty or both of them. But I still had a lot of fun with it. There's some really cool new things that they introduced. This is the first time in a Citadel episode that we've gotten a really different version of Rick, where he doesn't just sound like Rick, and you can see that version in the trailer. They're referring to him as the Boss Hog Rick, basically. And I talked to the voice actors about like creating the new versions of those characters and whatnot. So there's some cool stuff there for sure.
Yeah, I want to transition into that interview in just a minute. But Michael, I know you write about this show a lot for the site. So what has your relationship been with Rick and Morty as a series over the course of the show? Did you start watching it from the beginning or did you come to it late? And what do you think about like kind of the arc of the show overall?
So I came into the show sometime between season 3 and season 4. So My relationship to the show is basically first 3 seasons, I binged it all in one go. I loved it, but I think watching it weekly is a completely different experience because, you know, if an episode doesn't land, you know, you're stuck with that episode for the whole week. So I kind of lost a little bit of love for the show in seasons 4 and 5, and then season 6... it really just clicked back into place and it felt like the same love that I had for like season 3. So Another thing I would say is the first 2 episodes I watched like were out of order. They both had Evil Morty in it. And it just gave me a completely different idea of what type of show this was. I didn't realize those were the only 2 episodes with him in like the whole first 4 seasons. I thought it was going to be like a more serialized show. So that was an adjustment as I got into it. the like narrative, the fan narrative around the show is that like the first two seasons were the best and then there was like a steep decline. Whereas I think it has been pretty consistent, I think. I think a lot of fans binged the first two seasons and then by season three they'd caught up and watched it weekly. So I think that explains at least part of why people don't like the later seasons.
Mm. Okay, so Brad, same question to you. What do you think about like the arc of quality of the show across these seasons so far?
Yeah, I think I would mostly agree with Michael. There's been some dips, but like it's never gotten to the point where it's been downright bad or anything like that. I think there were some times where it got a little too full of itself and caught up in its own kind of shenanigans that it had created, and maybe got like too deep into being playfully meta and complicated. That stuff can be fun, but it can also be kind of overwhelming after a while. But for the most part, I've enjoyed it just pretty much the entire, you know, run. I've never been exhausted from it. I started watching from the beginning before anybody really knew about it, and it was cool kind of to see people embrace it and see what the show was about, and that it was totally right up their alley as far as just having this dark sense of humor and this great spoof-like approach to various sci-fi and fantasy movies, but also with its own unique sense of humor about it as well. So, and it's been especially encouraging, I think, since Justin Roiland was fired from the show, to see that they've been able to still keep the momentum going, and it hasn't really lost much of what made it great. I think there was, you know, a slight adjustment to getting Ian Cardone and Harry Belden used to the roles of Rick and Morty. Some things that they've adjusted in for season 8 that they've improved upon for sure. But yeah, overall, I think, you know, it's been a really fun show to watch.
Okay, excellent. Well, you teased it. So let's just jump right into your conversation with Ian Cardone, Harry Belden, and Spencer Grammer right now.
So to begin with, first I want to start with Ian and Harry. This is your second season voicing Rick and Morty. I imagine the first season was probably a little nerve-wracking. So how have you felt this now with a full season under your belt? Was there anything you felt that was particularly challenging about the voices in that first season that you really wanted to hone in on and practice before coming back for a new season?
Sure. Always a happy challenge. But I think season 8 really gave some great opportunities on the page for these characters to explore the full range of their emotional life, the growth journey that Rick's been on for a while, certainly provides, along with Citadel-like episodes, an opportunity to explore the different iterations of and full range of Rick. So to really sink my teeth into that was a happy challenge to take on. And I think the demands were a little different for season 8 than for season 7. The nerves for me will never go away, just because I'll always be my own toughest critic, wanting to serve the, you know, serve the story, and just, you know, want to outdo myself, really. But the focus was for sure on just the acting and just, okay, let's, you know, take ownership of this role and serve the character and see what we can do with it, see how much we can play with him.
Yeah, I think doing the voice requires so much work that was kind of the bulk of the focus of season 7. Of course, delivering good acting as well. I think now that we've lived in it so long, we've sort of strengthened those muscles and done a lot of that training so that that can take up less brain space. So that while we're working on the show, it's way more about the acting and delivering the great stuff that we got on the page, like Ian was saying, because we got some really good stuff this season. I'm like so hyped even just thinking about how everyone's going to react seeing these episodes in season 8. Because I do think season 7 was here. I think season 8 just raised the bar. It's so good. But yeah, I think a little bit of that pressure is gone, but it's always going to be there. As Ian was saying, we're huge fans of the show, so like no one wants us to do a better job than ourselves, you know.
Yeah. Spencer, what has it been like watching Ian and Harry step into these roles and working with them for a second season?
Yeah, well, we don't necessarily work together, but we're doing the convention circuit, so I do get to spend a lot of time with them, and it's honestly an absolute pleasure. And I think it gives the writers so much to work with. There's a great episode this year that revisits the Citadel. I don't know if I think we can tease that. I think so. Yeah. You know, so we get to see all these different versions of Rick and Morty, and I was just absolutely blown away by their performances. And I think it creates like just so much more opportunity for the show to go in different places than we might have been able to previously. So I'm very grateful and happy and excited.
Now, when we're all watching the show, obviously we get to hear your voices as the characters, but is there anything physical about your performance that you find yourselves regularly doing that helps you all kind of get into character or get into like in the moment in certain scenes?
That's so funny. I mean, when I every time I do, I have like a really weird like I have like definitely like a tick when I'm working. Like if you video me like doing it, like I do the same thing before every take. I like take a step back and then take a step forward and like move in a certain way just to like and I'm not even aware that I'm doing it, but it's like my like warm up to like go into summer. And it usually takes me like a little bit to like warm up into the voice. But yeah, it's pretty, I mean it's pretty funny like how much my body needs that to just get like ready. And then you just stand because you can't move too much. You can't make any noise with your body because it just has to be your voice. So learning how to do that over these years has been, just a challenge and
Yeah, there's a
You
lot
guys?
of physicality that goes into it. Yeah, mine has like evolved over the almost two past 2 years. Like I used to like point up every time I was doing the voice as Morty because it was like helped my brain get like the high pitch, right? So now it's like evolved from like le actually like I think about going lower. It's weird. Like I push down with my diaphragm. I like push down with my diaphragm with one hand and then I raise my soft palate with the other hand. So I, every session I'm in, a lot of my lines, I'll literally be going like that. And like martial arts pose, you know, like so it's, you know, I will see what happens in the next season, what my physicality evolves into.
Ian, how about you?
I'm sure I've contorted my face and body in all kinds of different ways to get to the screaming Rick and all that. I will say in season eight, you're going to hear more burping, which means I've just had a lot more carbonated beverages in the booth to help me along with that.
Yeah,
So
I was wondering if you were the one doing the burps or if they just had such a large library of burps that you didn't need to.
any burp that you hear in my seasons are my genuine burps, and there is
Awesome.
a building library. Some of them are right captured in the middle of the line authentically. Other times, we'll just have a burp session at the end of a recording session, and then we'll just get a whole bunch of different ones. There's probably an entire MP3 minutes long of just me burping and going, "Oh, fuck you, Morty." You know, so it's you know, whether they'll ever use them or not, there's a bunch of options there.
That's awesome. Now, do you guys have any like an entry point or go-to line that helps you get back into character if you feel like you've like lost the voice or you're not quite nailing it?
Yeah, there's one for if I'm doing conversational Rick from season seven. That's Caribbean Queen, written by Hugh Jackman, age 16, and so that's usually my little touch point to come back into it. And then if I need to scream or do anything, there's a whole different vocal placement for a heightened yelling Rick that you know, I'll have to give a wubba lubba dub dub to get myself in there. And it's, you know, so depending on what the line calls for, we'll warm up into it.
Yeah, I've got usually my go-to is okay, I get it. Just because for whatever I remember, like I did that in one of my first sessions, and because that was like the line, and I said it, and they were just like, "That's it, that's it. Okay, hold that right there." That, you know, and I was like, "Okay." So that from then on, that was just what we used. And then yeah, like Ian said, there's other ones for if it's a more screaming one or a more angry reference and stuff like that. Yeah, it re really does help to kind of just reset.
Spencer, how about you?
Oh, I mean, I'll say like, oh my God, like, and just remember that I have like five or so syllables in any kind of vowel at any particular time. So like sometimes I'll be like, just make it like a little bit more summer because I'll be like too grown up or something. But that's usually my, I mean, yeah, there's like a lot. There's a lot of variation and no, there's not that much variation, but there's a lot of yelling, screaming is really like after screaming for 14 years on the show, like your voice gets tired, of like just blood curdling screams. But I'm like, I'm always working on vocal health now more than I used to. I'm grateful for the job that it does that. Like, I always say like acting is a healing art, right? Because you're going through the given circumstances of any character, you're talking about human storyline, like humanist storylines, right? We're talking about how it is to be human and conveying that to an audience and hopefully giving them a cathartic experience of their own experiences in life and hopefully making them laugh a little bit about it. So, I've grown a lot as a character in my own storyline, and Summer has too in hers.
Ian, we get to hear a new version of Rick that we haven't heard before in the Citadel episode. What was it like trying to figure out that balance of making sure that it still sounds like Rick while having that entirely unique, new, different voice.
I'm excited for the world to meet Boss Hogg Rick. We've already caught a glimpse that's been released, on social. So people have maybe seen this character, and that's what I was working from. It's always going to be Rick first. So for any different iteration, it's start with the regular Rick voice, the Rick we know and love, and then depending on the type of Rick that we're playing, how far can we go? And in this particular instance, it was a collaboration between myself, our director, and the writers of that episode. Because I think there was a particular sound that we wanted to achieve, and so giving them a few options to choose from, and then really honing in on it was a fun process. Where I might normally give 20 takes for a line for Rick, this was maybe 50. Just to really, just to give options, and that's where what led us to finally settling on what's in the final episode. And in the same way that this whole show gives us a multiverse of infinite possibilities to play with, these different iterations of Rick and the journey that he's been on, it gives an infinite emotional range and vocal range to play in, I think, too, that will still feel true to the character while offering something new and exciting that we'll hopefully see on t-shirts and Funkos everywhere.
Harry and Spencer are you guys hoping that maybe you'll get like to do some much more extreme variants of Morty and hopefully some variants of Summer that are different since we really haven't seen anything like that?
We get a little bit of it in the beginning of this episode of like,
Yeah, for sure.
grown up adult Summer essentially. So I love that I've been able to get to embody that. But there's so many more options. I always think of like when we were all like wasps at some point a couple of seasons ago, that even in the reality of being a wasp, like Summer is still like this angsty teenager, like trying to find who she is and like, standing up to her parents or whatever. Like I'm not a bee dad, right? Like that whole that whole. So I think there's so much more that we can obviously do. Because these characters are so well defined in certain ways, and they all have like really great essential authentic souls that have really evolved over all these seasons. So just throwing them anywhere is a blast. You could put me inside an orange or something, and I'd be what would that reality look like for Summer? It'd be like, ew, it's so wet, and sticky. Like it'd be like. Just, you can do anything and like I can find a way to find the joy of playing this character there.
Yeah, it would be yeah, it's always such a treat to play any different version of Morty or any of our characters that so yeah, I'm always excited to see if we do get these other variants what kind of voices they'll have and even if it's the same like literal voice what are we adding, what are we laying or layering on top of that to get this unique version of this multiversal character.
Very cool. Well, they're giving me the light, but it was great talking to you guys. Thanks so much, and I can't wait to see the rest of the season.
Thanks, Brad.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the season 8 premiere, which you all had a chance to see. I don't know if there's anything specific that you want to get into, but since our listeners will have had the opportunity to watch that episode, I just didn't know. I wanted to kind of like set it up for you guys. And I should say, I've not seen any of Rick and Morty myself yet. I'm probably
Ben.
going to watch it all. I know. I'm probably going to watch it all at some point, but it's fallen down on my list and I just have not gotten to it. But yeah, I just kind of wanted to like open the floor to you guys to talk about anything that you thought was worthwhile in the premiere episode. So if either of you have anything you want to say, go ahead and jump in.
I appreciated how the premiere was just a very good summer episode. For any fans of Summer, the character, I think they're going to be very happy with what the premiere gives us.
What do you think, Brad?
There's a great use of the Matrix in this season premiere, and actually Michael wrote a great article about how it kind of teases the coming to fruition of a certain fan theory that has been percolating for a little while, involving kind of like Summer's significance in the overall plot, and I think that's something that would be really interesting to see play out eventually, especially since there's Scott Martyr, who's the showrunner for Rick and Morty, has been for a little while now. He teased during season 7's like publicity run that season 10 would mark the end of like a saga of sorts, if you will, in Rick and Morty. And it's largely been assumed that that means like whatever has been going on with evil Morty will likely come to some kind of conclusion by the end of season 10. And so they've already written that entire season. They're getting ready to start writing season 11. So if the evil Morty saga comes to an end, there's a potentially interesting thread that could be picked up with Summer if they choose to go that route.
Fascinating. Okay. So, Michael, I want to ask you, do you think this is a show that feels like it's about the evolution and growth of its characters? Or is it more of a formula show where there's some interesting sci-fi stories, some jokes, and then everything is kind of back to the status quo at the end of every episode? And not that there's anything wrong with that. I'm just curious what you think about it.
I would say it's a little bit of both. I think the characters have definitely gotten softer and like healthier as the show's gone on. I mean, there's still like insane people and everything, but Rick especially has gotten a lot less abrasive, a lot less toxic towards Morty and the rest of the family, even though he's still crazy. Like with the interview we just heard, he's burping more, but he's for the most part, he doesn't burp nearly as much as he did in season 1, which is just, I think, a nice little character detail about him, how he has gotten his act together over the seasons, which has been a slow progress, but still a steady one and kind of wholesome to watch in a way.
It's probably also a byproduct of Justin Roiland no longer doing the voice, because Justin Roiland definitely enjoyed having some drinks while he was recording. And so the burps maybe would have been a little more natural, whereas Ian definitely had to go out of his way to find like a good drink that actually made it easier for him to burp, which like he said in the interview.
Yeah. So Brad, is there anything else you want to say about the premiere episode or the season as a whole or anything at all about Rick and Morty before we go to your last interview?
No, I don't think so. You know, there's from the episodes we've seen, it looks like this season's going to be pretty cool. There'll be some of the progression we've come to expect as far as the evolution of the Citadel plot lines involving all the various Rick and Morty variants that are out there. And, you know, if you love Rick and Morty and you've been around this long at this point, you know, you'll enjoy what you get to see. And I'm definitely excited to see what else the rest of the season has to offer, especially since they held back episode 2 from us, because I would have anticipated that would have been a Citadel episode, but it's not. So I wonder what in episode 2 they felt like they had to hold back so that press didn't see it ahead of time. So we'll find out in, you know, a little less than a week, I guess.
Picking back up on the thread that Michael laid down earlier about binging the show versus watching it weekly, what's your experience been with that, Brad? Like, do you prefer one way or the other?
I've had a little bit of a mix. I mostly watched it weekly for like the first probably 5 seasons. 6 was when I started to like fall behind a little more, and I would catch up like in like little episode batches here and there. 7, I think, was the one, not because of a lack of quality or interest or anything. It was more so just timing and being busy with other stuff. But 7 was the one where I watched like the first couple episodes, fell behind, and I think I ended up catching up like on the second half of the season, like in one little binge. So, you know, it works either way, because a lot of the times it's an adventure of the week scenario, even though there are serial aspects of the series. So it's no matter how you do it, you know, you're gonna enjoy yourself.
All right. So Michael, before we go, anything else that you wanted to say about the premiere or the season as a whole or the show as a whole?
Yeah. One thing I'll say is I feel like the show has gotten more focused in recent years, and by which I mean, like, it used to be there was an A plot and a B plot, and they were trying to get all the characters a moment in the episode. Whereas I feel like this season and season 7, they've been more comfortable with just leaving a character behind for the whole episode. Like, there are episodes in season 8 where, like, Jerry or Summer or just a character will just not be there, or they'll be mentioned, but they just won't get any focus. And I think, you know, some fans may not like that, but I do think that helps help the episodes feel more complete and more, like, well thought out. So I appreciate that aspect.
Excellent. Okay. Well, I think we're going to go to Brad's interview here. But before that, Michael, I want to say thanks for coming on. Do you want to tell people where they can find you online?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at 98MikeB, and I'm also on Blue Sky at, I believe, the same username. And yeah, that's all my social media. You can find me there.
Excellent. All right. So, Brad, you had a chance to speak with Dan Harmon, who co-created the show, and showrunner Scott Martyr. So let's go to that conversation right now.
So this is the second season of Rick and Morty with Ian Cardoni as Rick and Harry Belden as Morty. And I was just curious, what's it like been watching them step into these roles? And have you noticed any sort of evolution or advancement in their approaches as they came back for a second season?
Absolutely. I just feel like they just feel so much more comfortable in those roles that they're bringing, like, I feel like Ian's able to bring a lot of like emotional depth that I might not have otherwise seen. Like, I feel like that's something that's getting stronger. He's able to scream as Rick in a better way. He's been experimenting with what creates better burps. He, like, I saw him the other day bring in like a particular beer that he had over the weekend. And he's like, wait till you see what this can do to me. And sure enough, that guy was belching like crazy. I'm like, I love that you can write off burping as like a work thing.
That's awesome. Now, did you guys add any new writers for this season? Because I'm curious as to what you guys look for when hiring someone to join the staff. Do you want them to come with like an inherent love for all things like sci-fi pop culture that are referenced in the show, or is a more general sense of humor that vibes with the show on the page that more important?
I wish I could say that it didn't need to be criteria that you need to be a bit of a sci-fi aficionado, but I think you kind of need to, because I think that helps you leap past like a certain level of understanding that a lot of us are on, where like, we all have a shorthand that we all have a general knowledge of a lot of the shows and movies that exist out there, so that we don't have to bring anyone up to speed on Prometheus. We're all aware of it, so we could immediately kind of dissect it and do our own version of it. Whereas like someone who would come in maybe super green would need to do a lot of homework to kind of catch up with, I'd say, a lot of just the basic vernacular and chit chat that's going on in the room. So I do think that is a bit of a prerequisite. Normally tone, writing ability, those are the things that get you in the door. But it's really helpful that you're as big of a nerd as I'd say a lot of us are.
Dan, I know you've always got several irons in the fire, and Scott, you know, is acting as showrunner for Rick and Morty. So I'm wondering, what aspects of the show do you find yourself the most focused on? Are you giving notes on each script? Are you there to help break episodes in the writer's room?
The goal is to like try to pepper me in where I can do the least damage, and in fact avoid the lead. It's a tricky business, because it's like I'm gonna have thoughts about everything. So the question is, does that mean I'll kind of, if I'm watching like an animatic, I might go like, how come you guys didn't ask me about this earlier? And but then if you bring me in earlier, I mean, the secret answer is, well, because then you would have made it take longer. So there's a balance there. And I think it's like with Scott coming on board, the new philosophy that has paid off for my mental health and the show is like, the schedule wags the dog. Now, that doesn't mean the content that ends up on the screen is worshiping time over quality. It means like we worked backwards from what does it take for the show to be on schedule. The answer sometimes is like you need to be three seasons ahead writing. And so Scott is like the sort of he has to figure out like, well, how do you what do you bring Harmon in? And the answer is just like at every stage, and like how, like when is it too late to keep changing things? And when, you know, it's that's an ongoing thing, but there's been I don't want to take all of your time with one answer to one question. But
I would just yes and that by just saying that Harmon is just a critical stopgap. If I could show him a piece of everything at every stage, that would be my druthers, because he makes everything better. And if we have the ability to make to improve everything that he calls out at every stage, then we're winning. So that's certainly what we aspire to do with every episode.
Now, back at the end of 2023, around when season 7 was wrapping up, I read an interview with Scott where you mentioned a 10-season arc for the series. And I assume that might be something that wraps up the ongoing Citadel story, what's happened with Evil Morty and whatnot. So we're in the process of, you are writing season 10 right now.
We are through 10. We are about to start writing 11.
Okay.
I'd say we have something looking from 20,000 feet that will be a very rewarding, very satisfying cap to what I would call like a saga across 10 seasons.
Kind of like what's like a Marvel Cinematic Universe saga.
What were you saying?
Kind of like the end of like a Marvel Cinematic Universe saga, where like it ends something. And then...
I'd say where it's not like the show's fundamentally going to be different from 11 on, but like I think it'll be like, oh, cool, they really had an eye on something that when I look back across the 10, that's all pretty neat.
Do you have an eye on maybe what might be a new overarching story that would begin in season 11?
We're talking about things, but we haven't had the fun of really getting into it yet. The writer's room is just like weeks away.
That makes sense. Rick and Morty has had plenty of incredible guest stars over the years. Is there anyone that you're still trying to get on the show, maybe waiting for the right part, or anyone who you know wants to do the show and you're just still figuring out maybe what the best role for them might be?
That's a good question. There are a lot of cool people that come through all the time. I mean, I just directed Andy Serkis last week, which was super cool. If the role is right and it's the right size, the cool thing about animation is that you could tend to like the joke of live action is like, I want this person. And then you end up getting like, you want the A-list and you get the D-list. Like animation, you want the A-list and you can actually get the A-list, which is so nice because the job really ultimately boils down to like an hour at best of their work. And a lot of them at this point are huge fans of this show or of a child that's a huge fan of this show. So like that combination usually can land what are otherwise seen as whales.
If this interview is a chance to put out the bat signal on somebody, I Sam Rockwell comes to mind. That's a record I'll show up for. Usually if we stunt cast somebody, I'm like, I'll just make Scott have to direct them because I don't want to give Susan Sarandon. I have like a real, like, I can't tell a famous person how to act. So my big dreams are also my nightmares. Like, I made some joke with Matthew Broderick about like when he was done, I was directing over speakerphone and I was like, you got the day off now. And it was like, pause. And then he was like, yeah, that's great. Is this the first time anybody's ever made that joke? I don't have a wish list because it's like a list of people that I'm gonna like fucking like make an ass of myself in front of.
Now you mentioned Rick and Morty has some younger fans, some of which you probably weren't even born when some of the show's signature movie and TV references were most prominent. For this season, is there anything you think that younger fans should go out of their way to watch before the season begins that might increase their enjoyment of certain episodes?
I don't think anyone under 20 should be allowed to watch the show. I can't vouch for it with the new definition of what it takes to raise a kid. I would never, like, Scott's got kids and I'm always, they're getting to an age where, and I'm like, when would you allow these kids to watch some of the, I would be like, I don't know.
My 11-year-old's like, Dad, please. And I'm like, I just know in my heart, I don't write it for you. Like, and I don't need to hear the language or the thing, the learnings you'll get from it yet. But like, it's going to be hard. Like the dam is breaking. He's coming. He's coming for the show.
No, I don't know. There's no episode. I'd be like, yeah, bring your kids to this episode.
I think the show is kind of succeeding in that you don't need to necessarily do homework to kind of catch up with it. Like, it's not relying on you having seen it or relying on a pop culture thing happening in the now. Like, I think that's why this has got more staying power.
Now, have there been any significant discussions or development on the Rick and Morty movie? Is that something that is always kind of percolating in your mind, or is it kind of just on the back burner as you focus on the show?
I think, you know, we're working in very, you know, that's the privileges of being a child of Warner Brothers is Rick and Morty are already ending up in movies even when just we come back to work on a Monday and we're like, what? We're in Space Jam. So I think the perks of that should be, hey, what if we want to do a movie? And I think it's the right place to be for something like that to happen. And I would not stand in the way of it. Looking forward, we're, you know, continuing conversations about it.
It seems like there's a lot of enthusiasm to keep growing.
Right on. Well, they're giving me the light, but it was great talking to you guys, and I can't wait to see the rest of the season.
Thanks a lot, man.
All right, take it easy.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Okay, so typically at this point in the show, I think we would jump right into the news. But because I still have you, Brad, I think maybe now is a good time to transition into a discussion of your recent trip to Pixar. So tell me about that.
Yeah, so whenever there's a new Pixar movie, Pixar Animation usually sends out an invite to press to come to Pixar Animation's campus in Emeryville, California, which is near San Francisco. And they have like a little press day where you get to check out footage from the movie. Usually like about 30 or 40 minutes or so. And then you get to speak with some of the filmmakers and the animators and people in various crew member positions and department head positions. And they have like different experiences for you to check out to get more of a sense of the movie and behind the scenes and whatnot. So yeah, I went to Pixar in May to see some footage from Elio and learn more about the upcoming movie.
Okay, so I have to ask you about your thoughts about Elio going into this experience, because I think I've said on the podcast a few times that like that first teaser that came out a year ago, I think at this point, I was not really super on board with that. I wasn't really sure about the tone. And then I just watched the relatively recent trailer that came out. I think it was maybe a few weeks ago that debuted. I just watched that for the first time right before this conversation and was surprised at like the seeming change in tone that I detected between those two trailers. So I wonder if they heard some negative feedback about that initial teaser. So anyway, I just wanted to mention that and see what your standing was, what your thought was about Elio as you were going into this experience.
Yeah, I kind of felt the same way after the teaser. I thought it was a cute concept and an interesting one, but it wasn't something that I was completely sold on. And I actually had avoided watching the more recently released trailer because I wanted to kind of go into what they were going to show us at Pixar fresh and get a sense of the movie that way before I went back and watched the trailer. And I think you're right. They definitely did like a shift as far as tone and whatnot. The first teaser seems to be more focused on like the sci-fi adventure aspect of it, whereas the new trailer digs more into the more delightful side of the adventure, the friendship that develops between Elio and this alien slug kid named Glordon, and kind of the experience that Elio has visiting this otherworldly, you know, cosmic place where people from, aliens rather, from all over the galaxy come together to like figure out things for the rest of the universe. So yeah, it's I was surprised to see that shift in tone, but I think it also makes sense. And I don't necessarily know if it was part of the plan from the beginning, because it does feel like the kind of thing you would eventually dig into, kind of similar to how you don't get story beats in a teaser trailer. You get that when you get the full theatrical trailer. Mm-hmm. But I do think that that second trailer, or maybe it's the third trailer, I don't know, does paint a much better picture of the movie that we're going to get.
It kind of seems like the Elio character has been changed a lot between those trailers. So I wonder if there have been significant reworkings behind the scenes of changing what the movie originally was going to be. Because in that first teaser, he's like reluctant to get pulled in to the sci-fi, to like the alien tractor beam or whatever when they're kind of abducting him. And in this most recent trailer, he's like actively excited about that, which seems like a pretty big 180 for a character. So
yeah,
did you get a sense when you were there that anything changed? Did they address any of that stuff at all?
So I talked a little bit about this to the film's directors because previously Adrian Molina was the director on Elio, but he departed production at some point. It seems like there might have been creative differences, something like that. And some things did change between what Adrian Molina's original idea was and what the movie eventually became. So I wonder if Adrian's take was maybe a little more serious. And once Domishi and Madeline Sharafian came aboard, they might have figured out a different way into Elio as a character and to help make the story work and feel like it would connect better with audiences. So I think it does feel like that was probably the biggest change. And maybe that's why you see that shift in Elio's personality and like his lack of reluctance to be abducted later. And he's actually very eager to make it happen.
Interesting. Okay, well, let's go right now to that conversation with Madeline Sharafian and Domishi.
Hello. It's great to talk to you guys. Hello. And talk about Elio. Very exciting, very cool sci-fi adventure. Can you first talk about some of the cinematic inspirations that went into creating Elio's vibe and visual style and whatnot?
Yes. I was really excited to partner with our DPs, Derek Williams and Jordan Rempel, on diving into the aesthetics of the Spielbergian sci-fi movies like E.T., Close Encounters, and some of the more kind of scary ones like Alien and The Thing. And we watched them with a fine-tooth comb for the visual look, which gave Jordan a lot to work with. So we made these sort of darker, deeper shadows. We shot the film with an anamorphic lens, which I know it's an animated movie, but we use real cameras the same way a live-action film would. So you'll see little touches of that, like there's a red ring around a light that might be shining right at you. This is all for the film geeks. And also that little bit of noise. And one of my favorite things is atmosphere, where sometimes you'll watch a Spielberg movie and there's like mist in the room,
yeah,
and you're
100%.
Like, "What's? Where's this? Why is there mist in Elliot's bedroom? I don't understand."
Doesn't matter.
But that
looks cool.
There's something about that dreaminess that got us really excited, and it's about the way that you feel, not about what's real in a movie.
Yeah.
And that's what excites me about animation. And I'm really happy with the way things turned out. That was really fun to nerd out about. Yeah.
Now, I know the story of a Pixar movie evolves constantly throughout its development, and I was curious how it's drastically changed since before, because obviously Adrian Molina was around when it originated, and I feel like it's probably changed since then. So what are some of the biggest changes that happened between the early version and what we're going to get in theaters?
Yeah, I mean, with all of our movies, like, they're constantly changing. Yeah. Like, for example, Turning Red, like the movie I did beforehand, like the very first version I pitched, the story was very different than the final movie. That's kind of just our process at Pixar. These movies take 4 years because we are constantly rewriting and changing everything. I think the heart of it is still the same. It's still very much like Adrian's concept of like, what if the weirdest kid got abducted by aliens and had to represent Earth as its leader. So we kept that, but I think we infused a lot of our own kind of experiences with loneliness on Earth and the yearning to go to a place that like understood you, that like accepted you. I think a lot of that stuff was something that we kind of infused in a little bit later on. I think the character Olga as well kind of was more fleshed out as we were brought on the show, and we could kind of relate to her kind of dilemma of being this like fierce career woman who was suddenly kind of saddled with something that they didn't expect, soon grew to love and nurture.
I mean, it's crazy. All the characters and the sets are the same, but they're slightly different configurations, where Grygon used to be an ambassador, and one of our big shifts was giving Elio and Glordon someone to push up against, more of an antagonistic role, but also using Grygon more as a sort of mirror to Olga, as these two parents who don't quite know what they're doing yet, and then Elio and Glordon are these two kids who feel unwanted by them. So that was, I think, a really big shift that we made, sort of in the middle of the movie. But a lot of the pieces and bookends have stayed the same.
Yeah, and I've been a story artist on several movies here, and the trend I see, and especially like with all the movies, is like the first couple versions of the of the movie that you put up are going to have like everything in the kitchen sink, like all the themes that you want to explore, a million characters that you want to include in there, all the gags. And then as you go through each screening and you put it up and you rewrite it, the story kind of simplifies and solidifies and kind of turns into kind of like one idea and one voice. And I think that's kind of how I feel like what happened with Elio, like from the Adrian version to the final version.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're giving me the light, so that's my time. But thank you so much. It was great talking to you.
Okay, so the idea of Adrian Molina, who co-directed Coco, if people don't immediately recognize his name, him leaving the project and these folks taking over, that's happened a bunch of times in Pixar's history. So what did you think about the footage that you saw? Because sometimes when you see some of the stuff, especially in an early form, you can have like red flags going off and like alarm bells and like, oh man, I don't know if this is going to come together. But were you ultimately won over by what you saw on your trip?
Yeah, I definitely was. I definitely had more questions after the footage, which is strange because usually you get more, you know, answers about stuff and you feel like you have a thorough understanding of the story. But because this time they played for us a selection of scenes rather than like the entire first act and like second and a half of like the second act, it felt like there were gaps that I didn't fully know what had happened or what had caused it. Like, for example, Elio has an eye patch that you see in that he wears in the movie. He doesn't have that eye patch from the beginning, and we didn't find out how he got it. So I know based on seeing concept art and certain discussions and whatnot, it seems like there's a sequence where like he gets bullied by some kids at a camp on the fort that his aunt is situated on and where he lives. So I wonder if there's some kind of like fight he gets into or something where he has to like wear that eye patch. And then like maybe it helps because like it feeds into this idea of like, oh, maybe he's like a space pirate or something like that, making him, you know, easier to accept as like this ambassador from Earth. The footage was definitely encouraging. Elio is super cute, for me, the big selling point of like what made it really fun to watch and delightful is the little space slug kid Glordon that I mentioned before. He's kind of in a similar position as Elio, where he kind of feels out of place where he's at and doesn't feel like he can like live up to, you know, certain expectations of the alien species, especially his father, who's this big, you know, intimidating alien guy, and he's voiced by Brad Garrett, and so him and Elio have this bond, and so like they become best friends, and they're hanging out all over the Communiverse, which is where, you know, this intergalactic federation of, you know, aliens is that he meets and whatnot, and so the friendship that develops between them and the bond that they have was really cute to see. And the voice of Glordon in particular is just really delightful. He brings a lot of exuberance and just cute energy to the table, and I think going to be something that people really latch onto. The kid's name is Remy Edgerly, and he's just super cute. And so that was a big part of the movie, I think, that was helped push me into being on board with it, because I still don't feel like I have the best grasp of like all of the story beats, and not necessarily in a bad way. But if anything, I'm curious to see how it plays out and how things escalate.
Yeah. It was kind of reminding me a little bit of How to Train Your Dragon. I mean, hearing you talk about that, like the Glordon and his father relationship, where he's got these societal expectations of his culture and everything. And then also a character becomes severely injured and becomes like a nice representation moment for anybody in the audience who has that same disability or whatever. Like Hiccup gets pretty severely injured in that movie. And so, man, like if they have Elio get in a fight with these kids and they take his eye out or something, that's going to be a pretty serious thing for a Pixar film.
And I will say, even though we don't know how he got the eye patch, the injury that he has, we do see in a scene that it's not like a permanent thing. Like he hasn't lost his eye. So,
okay, good.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would have been pretty extreme. Okay. So I guess like, what else did you see when you were there? Like physically, what did you do when you were at Pixar? Cause I've been on a couple of these set visits before, not to Pixar, but I've been to like Walt Disney Animation, and they'll take you around and have you talk to a bunch of different folks who worked on the movie in different departments and show you like little clips of like, here are evolutions of what the animation looked like and how character designs changed and like what we did with the sound mixing and all kinds of like different aspects of production. So was there anything like that that stood out to you that maybe like Pixar is trying to say, hey, we've never done this as a studio before. Here's a big selling point for us. Like I did the one for Finding Dory, and they were talking about how they like developed a whole new program for how water works in Pixar, for example. So anything like that that jumped out at you?
Yeah, definitely. So in the creation of the Communiverse, which is, you know, where Elio is abducted to, and there's this intergalactic kind of federation of alien life forms. The creation of this world was really complex because it's basically these four rotating curved discs that each have their own environment, and they have topography on either side of the disc. So like it was complex just creating the mere existence of the Communiverse, but they took a lot of inspiration from like microscopic life, and like they wanted to give like the world and like the different places like kind of this transparent, iridescent kind of like microscopic feel to it. And so they found that they were having to confront a lot of issues with like figuring out lighting and stuff earlier than they typically might, because the lighting was important in making sure that the environments looked at the way that they wanted them to. So they actually had a new piece, a new tool set, I think that's how they refer to it, called Luna, that they had been developing, that they were able to use the prototype for in Elio, that allowed them to do the lighting earlier in the production pipeline. Because usually at Pixar, the lighting is one of the last things they do in animation. And this time it was such an important part of perfecting the look of the world of the Communiverse that they needed to do it earlier in the process. So Luna helped them do that, and it made things a lot easier for them to see what they were creating and how it looked before they got to the final stage, before it might have been too late. So that was really cool to hear about. And then we got to check out the early animatic versions of certain sets in VR, which is how they do a lot of shot planning for animated movies. They have filmmakers put on MetaQuest headsets, and like they walk around very basic versions of the various sets so that they can plan shots, figure out how to shoot characters, where they want to move the camera and whatnot. And they have a special like handheld iPad rig that allows them to act as the camera and move it around and change the different lenses and whatnot. So that was cool to experience. And then for the second time, I was able to do the voice recording at Pixar, which is a lot of fun. It's a little different than what they normally do, because usually they're animating to, you know, the voice that they've already gotten from the actors. But for us, we're trying to do our voice in time with the animation that's already done. And so,
yeah, it's like ADR basically, right?
Yeah. So they, when I did Inside Out 2's press day, we were the voice of Joy, and they sent us like a clip with our voice in it and everything. We posted about it on Slash Film if you want to check it out. This time we got to be the voice of Glordon. And so it was a little easier because the voice isn't someone that you're familiar with, like Amy Poehler. You know, for me, it's not me as, you know, a dude trying to do Amy Poehler's, you know, female voice. And yeah. So I was able to like give myself like a higher pitched voice to sound like a kid like Glordon does, which was a lot of fun. And this time, they actually had brought in the lead, Jonas Kibrieb, who voices Elio in the movie, to do lines with us. So that was a lot of fun.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. Man, I just like, I want people to be able to experience this stuff. I know it's ridiculous. It's like impractical. They're not going to just open up Pixar for the kinds of experiences that they invite these journalists to do. But I think the closest thing that maybe our listeners can do to experience some of this stuff is just really dive into the bonus features on the discs, the Pixar discs, because I think you can get a lot of the same information and a lot of the same vibe of these experiences by just exploring and watching those featurettes, because they do a really good job putting that stuff together. And it just, every time I you know, go on a set visit or even do a deep dive into any kind of movie's bonus features, it gives me a whole new appreciation for how much work goes into creating this stuff. And like, there's so much stuff about animation that I'm not familiar with. Like, I've been on live action film sets. I've, you know, I worked as an extra for a little while when I was living in LA, and like, you know, I kind of have a sense of like what a movie set looks like. And I think people can wrap their heads around that, the tactility of that, a little bit more easily than animation, where like literally every single thing you're seeing is being created in a computer. And there's just, yeah, the pipeline that you were talking about is just, it's something that is a little bit more ephemeral for, I think, people to understand. And anything they can do, especially if you're an animation fan, to wrap your head around that a little bit better, you know, I think it's a worthwhile endeavor. So
piggybacking off that, actually, one of the things I got to do for the first time on this Pixar visit was we actually got to play with their proprietary animation software, Presto, which was so overwhelming. I've always
what do you mean when you say play with it? What does that mean?
So they had a presentation set up showing us Presto and how they use it to animate individual characters. And they had three different characters that we could choose from that we could figure out how to do like little animations for. It's such a complex piece of software to learn in the very short amount of time that we were given. The presentation was maybe like, I don't know, 5 or 7 minutes. And then we got like 10 minutes to play around with it to like animate the character a little bit. And there's a lot of things that are like automated in it to make things easier. So like you can click certain things and it's like, oh, Glordon, you know, walks, or like he smiles like that. And then you can tweak little things. And like, it was cool because I've always been curious about this kind of stuff, is like, how much are they adjusting manually themselves and whatnot? And you get to see this like kind of blueprint-esque layout basically of the character and all of the different pieces on the character's face and body that you can move, from like moving its lip ever so slightly to like making it the limbs move around and everything, and trying to get like a grasp on it. I felt like I was kind of just starting to figure it out, and then it's like, okay, we're done, and it's like, come on. Like I would have loved to have spent so much more time like just playing with it to like be able to like create just like a little moment of like doing something with a character to do that. But like it gave me such a newfound appreciation for like what the animators do, and you know, understanding like how they're able to do what they do with characters and whatnot too, was a very cool thing to finally learn and see in action.
Yeah, the like the artistry that goes into that, like I love those videos that you see pop up sometimes of animators using themselves as models and then putting that side by side with what they're ultimately able to do with the characters that they're working on. So like these animators just like set up a little camera in their homes, and they're like in their kitchens or something, and they're just like doing these crazy physical movements and trying to capture the physicality of the characters and then matching it to that, so it has like a sense of real weight and movement to it that people can understand. So yeah, just very cool stuff overall. So all right, well, I think that's going to do it for this little section. Thanks for joining me, Brad, and I'll catch you next time.
Cool.
All right, joining me to talk about the news, we have Slash Film editor Jacob Hall.
Hello, hello.
And Slash Film editor BJ Colangelo.
Hi, hi, hi.
All right, folks. So let's run through a bunch of news items here. First up, Avengers Doomsday has been pushed back from May 1st, 2026 to December 18th of 2026. And then Avengers Secret Wars, which was supposed to come out in May of 2027, is now coming out on December 17th, 2027. There's not really a ton of details for us to really dig into. Nobody actually offered up any like true, genuine reasoning for why this delay is happening, other than like, these are probably going to be some of the biggest movies ever made, and like they want to take their time and get them right, you know, that kind of thing. But I was just wondering if either of you had any thoughts about these, if this like ruins your 2026 now that you have to wait until December to see this, any reaction at all to these movies being pushed back a few months?
Well, Ben, if this is the worst thing to happen in 2026, they're in for a pretty good year. I don't think it won't crack the top 1,000 worst things that happen in 2026. Mark my words on that, Ben. But to me, look, I am extremely pro Thunderbolts. The movie is really good. It's also not doing the box office that I think anybody thinks it should be doing right now. It's going to do okay in the long run, but it's not going to be a huge hit. I think this is a case of Marvel rightfully realizing that this thing has to work. It has to be knocked out of the park. And the Russo brothers' the way they make these movies is really piecemeal. What actors are available? What schedule can we slide in? Can we write another scene for this character? They really are assembled like puzzles, and it doesn't always work, but it worked for Endgame, and it worked for Infinity War, and I think giving them another year, you know, a little less than a year on each movie, to make sure the puzzle works is the only way to guarantee that this is going to be a movie worth the time, because they can ill afford another Captain America 4, Ben.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, Doomsday is now coming out on the same day as Dune Messiah and Ice Age 6, and Secret Wars is now coming out the same day as Lord of the Rings, The Hunt for Gollum. So, BJ, do you think any of these studios are going to blink at all, or do you think that's actually how it's really going to shake out and all these movies are going to be released on those days?
Oh, I think there's going to be some shuffling that happens, and the delay did not surprise me at all. Once they did the Doomsday chair thing, I was like, there's no way in hell this movie is coming out on time. That's too many schedules of too many A-listers that you have to juggle. Absolutely not.
Yeah, and they've said that that's not even the full cast, so who knows how much more difficult it is to get all the people that they haven't announced yet. So
yeah, I can't say names out loud, but I know somebody who I trust was just telling me that there's a certain Marvel actor who they're desperate to get in the movie, but they are currently filming something else. It's literally going to be, if they wrap on time, they'll be in Doomsday, and if they don't, then they won't be. Then the delay happens, and my guess is the actor will be. So it really is. That's literally how they make these movies. I'm not saying it's the right approach for every movie, but it's worked for Marvel in the past, as long as they're not like rushing things. So I don't know. This is very much the case where they have the resources to throw money at these problems until they get it fixed. So hopefully it works. Fingers crossed, because after Thunderbolts, I'm prepared to like Marvel again. I'm primed. I'm ready. Just make it good. Just make it good, please.
Okay. Well, speaking of making it good, Dwayne Johnson, who is taking a break from big budget tentpoles to make a smaller character focused drama called The Smashing Machine for A24 and director Benny Safdie that's coming out later this year, is reteaming with A24 for a psychological thriller called Breakthrough that's written by Zeke Goodman, who is an actor who's appeared in TV adaptations of I Know What You Did Last Summer and Cruel Intentions. And this is going to be his first produced screenplay. The story is set in turn of the millennium Southern California, and it follows an alienated young man who comes under the influence of a motivational guru whose intoxicating charm masks his morally questionable methods of manipulation and his own concealed darkness. And Dwayne Johnson is playing the guru. So, BJ, I know you're a big wrestling fan. I'm sure you have some thoughts about old DJ The Rock here. So what do you think about this?
I feel like the massive failure of Black Adam broke his brain in the best possible way, because I think it was the first time that he realized that life is not like wrestling. You're not guaranteed success just because you're The Rock. And I think he needed that. I think he needed to get his ass kicked a little bit, which he metaphorically did by that movie. I'm very excited for The Smashing Machine because I think that he needed somebody that was going to challenge him to play a role that wasn't just him being The Rock in everything. And based on what this script sounds like, I think we're probably dealing with a little bit of these like pickup artist culture. If it's turn of the millennium guru targeting an alienated young man, that's what I'm gathering here. And mm-hmm. I am here for Dwayne Johnson's heel era in cinema. He's been playing good guys for a little too long for my liking.
Yeah, leaning into that natural charm that he has and manipulating that for evil in a role is going to be really interesting to see. Jacob, you have any thoughts on this one?
He's a good actor. And like BJ said, he's been riding this high of being The Rock for 20 years. And I'm not a wrestling fan in the sense that I watch it, but I know just enough to be dangerous. And I've seen clips of him playing, you know, his heel self. And he's such a good sleazy villain that like to leave that untapped on screen. I mean, BJ, how long has it been since The Rock played a villain? Was it Doom, maybe the 2005 Doom where The Rock last played a villain?
Yeah, it's been a while. I mean, he's done some heel stuff here and there on WWE when he does like his little pop-ins, but really, like, acting-wise, no. And even then, his like villains are still so likable, which I think will benefit him for this new movie.
Yeah, I'm all in for this new era of The Rock. I hope Black Adam was the humbling he needed. So let's see what happens next.
Yeah, if this will get us back closer to like the Pain and Gain era of The Rock, then I'm all for it. So Alex Garland, the director of movies like Ex Machina and Annihilation and Civil War, is going to be directing an Elden Ring movie for A24. Elden Ring is based on a video game that I've never played. Jacob, I know you're a big fan of this game, or at least if you're not a huge fan of it, you've put a lot of time into it. So what do you think about this blending of director with subject matter?
Ooh, I'm a huge Elden Ring fan. I'm a big fan of From Software, the company that made it. All people listening who've played Bloodborne 10 times, I'm one of you. But Elden Ring is really exceptional and really interesting. And it's a video game-ass video game, though. I mean, it's one of those things where you look at it and it's so specifically crafted and made for the video game medium. I'm very curious how it can function as a movie. Because we're talking about From Software's storytelling style is that they don't tell stories. All other games, including Elden Ring, which is a massive dark fantasy horror story, are about the character being plunged into a world where the story has already happened, and you can pick up pieces of the story here and there. You pick up an item and read a description. You learn a piece of lore. You find optional boss fights that may explain what happened to somebody you heard about in a scroll somewhere. And the games are an act of exploration, discovery, and combat where the story comes together as much or as little as you want it to. And if you choose to just play through and not learn any story, you can still get a great, satisfying experience out of really fun exploration and combat and being in a creepy, terrifying, dangerous place, which is how all their games feel. All their games feel dangerous. Like you feel like they have this sense of unease. And all this is also why Alex Garland is interesting, because Alex Garland's movies have that sense of unease. His movies feel like they take place in dangerous places. All of his movies are about what it's like to be constantly under threat in one way or another. And his movies often deliberately dodge easy answers. They dodge traditional narrative. They dodge answers and just keep on raising more and more questions. So the ironic thing is that Alex Garland is actually the perfect choice for an Elden Ring movie because his cinematic style goes against so many cinematic rules. So I'm really interested to see if this actually happens. We're talking about a world with the scope of Lord of the Rings here. It is a massive world, but it's gruesome and R-rated and opaque by design. So I hope they let Garland cook here. I hope they let him lean into why the games work, which is the sense of mystery and the sense of you don't belong here. Something bad happened. You need to get out, which is how I feel every second I'm playing Elden Ring.
Yeah, some of what you're describing just does not really sound conducive to a traditional narrative. And I guess it's a good idea that Alex Garland is on board here because he doesn't always lean into traditional narratives. So like maybe he's not going to present the most straightforward version of this story. But yeah, it sounds like kind of aesthetically it's up his alley, but I'm curious to see if he's going to write this movie or who's going to come on to write it and try to wrangle all of that lore and mystery and stuff you're talking about into something that's like cohesive for people who have never played the games, because this is an A24 movie. Sounds like it's going to continue A24's trend of making things that are a little bit more expensive than they used to make to try to go for some of that kind of low blockbuster energy, you know, like lower tier blockbuster stuff, like grabbing that audience. And yeah, it sounds like they could pull it off here if they get everything right. But they're basically what I'm saying is they're not going to just be able to rely on people who've played the game to come out. They're going to need this to be like a crossover hit for it to justify its existence, I'm guessing, based on what they're probably going to spend on it. So BJ, did you ever play Elden Ring?
I haven't. Any of the video games that are like this expansive in its world become really overwhelming for me. But I do have a lot of friends who are ride or die for this that are very, very excited about this movie. But also, I think a lot of them are hesitant because A24 isn't super known for having huge budgets on a lot of movies. So this kind of feels like they're entering a new territory.
Yeah. So speaking of video game movies, Legendary is making a live action Street Fighter film based on the classic game. BJ, did you ever play that one back in the day?
Oh, yes, I did. I played a lot of Street Fighter.
Okay, so I did too when I was a kid. And there was a 1990s movie starring Jean-Claude Van Damme and Raoul Julia that was somewhat disastrous, but that is not stopping the IP train from chugging ahead here. So Katao Sakurai, I think I'm pronouncing that name correctly, who directed the very funny Eric Andre, Lil Rel Howery prank movie Bad Trip a few years ago, is directing this Street Fighter film, and the following actors are now in talks to appear in the movie. So Jason Momoa, Roman Reigns from Hobbs and Shaw, Andrew Koji from Warrior and Gangs of London, and Noah Centineo from recently Warfare, and then I think he really kind of broke out into All the Boys I'd Loved Before. So I mean, Jacob, like, as a video game person, what do you think about another live action Street Fighter film, and then what do you think about this collection of people potentially leading it?
First of all, I'm disappointed that Danny and Michael Philippou are no longer attached to this. They're the directors of Talk to Me, you know, that really terrific little horror movie from a few years ago, and I would have loved to see what they did with this. I feel like them not being attached lowers my interest significantly. But the beauty of Street Fighter has always been, here are a bunch of very different weirdos fighting each other. Can the sumo wrestler beat the ninja? Can the dictator beat, you know, the military soldier from America? And it's what the Mortal Kombat movie did so wrong a few years ago, which was it balanced out all the characters to give them all the same magical powers. And it's not the fun of a fighting game. The fun of a fighting game is these wildly divergent personalities hitting each other in the face and who's going to win. I've never been good at these games. I'm terrible at fighting games, but I love the appeal of, you know, mismatched or interesting matched fighters. And I remember when they made the last Street Fighter movie, last live action one, The Legend of Chun-Li, which was just a very generic, low budget B-movie thriller that Street Fighter in name only. I'm like, why? What is the point in this?
If you're not gonna forgot that even existed. Kristen Kruk from Smallville was in that. I totally forgot about that movie.
So I guess my whole thing is, as long as the focus is on mismatched fighters getting into fights in interesting locations, and the fights are well shot, you're already a step above Mortal Kombat. You're already a step above Legend of Chun-Li. So let's see what happens. I will say this is a very unique cast. I think I can already start imagining some of these faces on particular Street Fighter characters. So yeah, I'm hesitantly on board, but like I said, I would have preferred to see the Philippou version, because I just can't imagine those guys making a boring movie.
Yeah. There's a fan site out there that suggests that Jason Momoa is going to be playing Blanca. BJ, do you have any thoughts on that, if that turns out to be true?
Yeah, so the two rumors that I've seen is that Jason Momoa is Blanca, which I think would be so funny, because he would bring such like chaotic energy to it, and he would be perfect. And then they're also saying that they think that Roman Reigns is going to play Akuma, which I would be very into. That is my tribal chief. I would love to see him act, because Ben, I know you're not super familiar with wrestling. Roman Reigns is The Rock's cousin. He is also what WWE has been trying to find their second coming of The Rock, and they've been pushing Roman Reigns for the better part of a decade at this point. But I think that he is a genuinely good actor, and he has been needing a project to showcase that he's a good actor. And I think this would be perfect. And also, anytime you're getting Roman Reigns and Jason Momoa in the same movie, I'm happy, because they weirdly look like each other's like Waluigi, and it's perfect.
I will say, as a non-wrestling watcher, the YouTuber Super Eye Patch Wolf has a 2.5 hour long video breaking down Roman Reigns' career trajectory in WWE. And it's one of the most fascinating things I've ever seen in my entire life. Roman Reigns' career, like where it began, where it went, and where it is now, has more drama than like the best season of Game of Thrones. So I recommend checking out that video.
Yeah, that's real.
Wow. Man, Jacob, your viewing habits, man, are just like totally, that is so outside of the realm of something that I would spend my time doing, is like as a non-wrestling watcher to watch a 2.5 hour video about a wrestler. It's just like deranged behavior to me, but I love you. I love you for it. So okay.
Cinema,
so it also appears that the internet really wants Alan Ritchson, who plays Reacher in the Prime Video series, to play Guile in the Street Fighter film, but there's absolutely no evidence that that is happening at this point. I think it's purely based on looks and maybe like a Boss Logic fan art or something along those lines. But Ritchson was actually in the news a few days ago for a legitimate project. He is going to star in a new movie called Fortune, which is being produced by Ritchson and Jerry Bruckheimer, and Neil Widener and Gavin James, who are a couple of the writers behind a Minecraft movie, are writing the screenplay. And the reason that I'm interested in this is because Fortune is being referred to as Memento meets Raiders of the Lost Ark. So I don't really know what that means, but Alan Ritchson in like a maybe swaggering adventure kind of thing with like a dark memory component to it. I don't really know, but Jacob, it sounds like it might be up your alley.
Yeah, the only dirty words in that description were Minecraft movie, because I haven't talked about it on this show. I'm not sure if I've ever had the time to do it, so I'll say it now. A Minecraft movie is one of the worst major releases I've seen in a long time, and Jared Hess is a blight upon art. But you know what? I love Alan Ritchson. I love adventure movies. I love the idea of him probably wearing a tight shirt as he struts across a desert, backlit by the sun. I feel like it's a genuine tragedy that Tony Scott is not around to film Alan Ritchson. I feel this very, very strongly. And
God. Why would you say something like that? Because now that's all I'm ever going to want, and I can't have it.
This sounds interesting. And the fact that it's not, a sequel or a remake, an original adventure movie starring the most handsome, beefy man around is very exciting news. So I'm hoping that the Minecraft movie stink is all Jared Hess, and that the script here is from folks who didn't contribute to why that movie is incredibly racist. The Minecraft movie is racist, and no one's talking about it. It's like a really racist movie. Like, it's anti-Semitic imagery in it. It's born from the game's original designer being anti-Semite too. So it's all in there, but no one's talking about it. Anyway, Alan Rich and Jerry Bruckheimer adventure sounds good.
This is neither here nor there, but I just wanted to mention, just in terms of a brand new adventure movie, kind of treasure hunting type of thing, Raiders of the Lost Ark mold. I just wanted to maybe ward off some of our listeners from watching Fountain of Youth on Apple TV Plus, which is the new John Krasinski, Natalie Portman adventure. And it is just terrible. Guy Ritchie directed it, and it's very, very bad. So as long as we're crapping on things, I think this is a good little moment to do that.
Guy Ritchie, real quickly, he must be really good in The Room, right? And he must turn things in on time and under budget. It says, I cannot think of another director in recent memory who's under-delivered creatively more often than Guy Ritchie, who keeps on getting major pieces of work. He is a mystery to me. What happened, Ben?
I don't know. It's like him and Akiva Goldsman or something. Like the two of them, if they team up and make a movie, God help us all, I think, is what that boils down to. But all right. So a couple more items and then we'll wrap it up here. So HBO has hired a trio of young actors to star in its Harry Potter TV show. You've never heard of any of them. They'll likely become household names when the show ends up being a smash hit, inevitably. You can read more about that at the link in the show notes. Because we don't know who they are, we don't even really have anything to say about this. I just wanted to kind of put it on people's radar in case you are not paying attention to that and have some vague interest in it. And then finally, I just wanted to mention that Hacks is coming back for a fifth season. So as we're recording this, I was going to ask you, PJ, the season 4 finale is tomorrow night. We've not seen that yet. I thought the penultimate episode of this season, the episode 9, I think it was, the last one that aired, was tremendous. Like one of the best that they've ever done. So do you think this show has the juice to go for 5 seasons and potentially beyond? Because they didn't say it's going to be the fifth and final season.
Oh, yeah. The penultimate episode that you're talking about is legitimately one of the best television episodes I've seen all year. It's so, so good. Gene Smart, you better make more room on that Emmy shelf because you're getting it again. I was under the impression that Hacks was ending after season 4. I think I might have even talked about it on the podcast and how upset I was, but I don't remember because time is meaningless and my memory is Swiss cheese. But I am so happy that it's coming back for season 5. I love that. I think that this is going to be, Deborah and Ava continue to try to make it work in Hollywood in a new way. Not going to spoil anything, but like we're going to be dealing with Deborah, dealing with the issues of like a non-compete clause. Like, what does that look like for a season 5? I'm all about it. I'm all about it.
Jacob, are you watching Hacks?
I have not seen a single second of Hacks. I'm sorry, BJ.
Man, it's so good, dude.
Jacob,
it's
you will
really,
love it.
Really, really great.
Like, I promise you will love it. It has like a very similar feeling to it. As like the studio, but a little bit in your face, way more gay. And Gene Smart, so good. But also Hannah Einbinder does not get nearly enough credit for how fantastic she is on this show. God bless, one of our best Nepo babies.
But does it contain one or more murder bots?
Unfortunately, I would say no murder bot. However, you do get plenty of like painfully awkward people making musings about the world around them.
Okay, this is fair. That's murder bot enough.
All right, well, I think that's going to do it for this segment and for today's episode as a whole. I'm going to switch things around next week and do the news up front. So just teasing that now, because I'm getting a lot of feedback from listeners about where things should go in the podcast. And I welcome all of your feedback. Send all of that questions, comments, concerns, mailbag topics, all that stuff to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. But you can find more about a lot of the stories that we mentioned on the show at slashfilm.com. I will link to some stuff in the show notes as well. You can subscribe to Slash Film Weekly on Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps us out a lot. And tell your friends about the show. We'd really appreciate that. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you all next week.
Offer valid on standard browsers, U.S. only.
When I heard about Date My Age, I thought, really? But there I was in my empty, quiet house, my laptop on the kitchen counter, and I typed in my name. Looking for a man between the ages of 40 to 60? Sure, why not?
Date My Age is different. With verified profiles, you can feel safe and secure to explore meaningful connections with interesting and mature singles.
Date My Age made it really easy. I could join and view online profiles for free. All of a sudden, my empty house wasn't so quiet anymore. I got so much attention, it just made me feel seen and alive. Date My Age helped me start a totally new chapter in my life.
Find a friend, a lover, a partner at Date My Age. Get 60% off when you join at datemyage.com today. That's datemyage.com to connect with thousands of singles worldwide. datemyage.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.